Thank you so much to everyone who came to the workshop last Saturday on dealing with rage and your health and everything that goes along with that. If you missed that and you want the replay, send me an email and I'm happy to send you the information for that. The next workshop is going to be on chronic illness and friendships. That was a big thing that came up in the last workshop. People wanted to go over that one next. So we're going to talk about how to reach out without feeling like a burden, when to reach out, kind of how to maintain consistent relationships when you're feeling chronically ill. We really want our lives to be full and not, you know, shrinking more and more and more into this isolated cocoon, because that really exacerbates physical pain. So it is a tricky thing to navigate, and that's why the next workshop will be 90 minutes just on that topic. And again, it's the same format as last time, where it's some education, some PowerPoint slides, but also some conversation throughout the whole presentation where you're engaging with me, and then some a Q&A time at the end. So the link for that is in the show notes. Additionally, if you are a resident of Georgia or Florida, then I have a therapy group that is starting April 2024. The workshop that I just mentioned a moment ago, that's for anyone. It's not therapy, but this is a therapy group and is open to residents of the states that I'm licensed in. So this group will be 12 sessions long weekly. They're 90 minutes and they are virtual. They're via video. It comes with a digital workbook, and the group format is a little bit of education, where I'll be starting each session with an educational component around things like grief and identity work, working through anger, guilt and self-blame, fear of your body. That's a big one that we'll probably talk about a lot. And symptoms like brain fog, physical pain, chronic fatigue, dizziness, all of that. We'll be learning some pain management techniques and skills and practicing those in a way that is genuine and hopefully will stick, because we can learn a lot of these things and then feel like we know it and then never do it, or just feel like it doesn't work for us. And really, it might be that we didn't have that helping hand, that warmth throughout the learning process. I think that's what happens a lot of the time, is we're trying to learn something in our brain. We don't have any support around it. And then we feel like we know it, but it didn't work for us because we didn't really have all of the follow through. And again, that follow through usually only happens when you have really warm, genuine support. So that's what I'm hoping to provide with this group. If you have out-of-network benefits with your insurance, then super bills will be provided. If not, then it's just a private paid group. And I want to offer a couple of bonuses as well. I'm calling them bonuses because if you live in Florida, this might not be feasible, but we're going to do an in-person meetup at the end of each month. And so that'll be 3 meetups in total, but that will be in Atlanta. If you're in Florida and you want to travel up this way, that would be amazing. But just know that's not a requirement of the group, and it's really just an extra thing that I want to do because I think virtual work is amazing. And sometimes that in-person aspect can really just tie everything together. That will be a bonus. And then another bonus session, and again, I'm calling this a bonus because it's not mandatory, and it really depends on if you have someone you would want to bring with you or if they would even agree to attending. But at the end of the program, or maybe 2/3 of the way through, I haven't decided yet, there will be a session, a group session, where your family members can attend the group to learn about how they can better support you in your journey. So that's the group therapy program. And again, I will have a link in the description box below with more information for that. But if you're interested in either of those things, click those links, or you can email me at destiny@destinywinters.com. The Chronic Illness Therapist podcast is meant to be a place where people with chronic illnesses can come to feel heard, seen, and safe while listening to mental health therapists and other medical professionals talk about the realities of treating difficult conditions. This might be a new concept for you, one in which you never have to worry about someone inferring that it's all in your head. We dive deep into the human side of treating complex medical conditions and help you find professionals that leave you feeling hopeful for the future. I hope you love what you learned here, and please consider leaving a review or sharing this podcast with someone you love. This podcast is meant for educational purposes only. For specific questions related to your unique circumstances, please contact a licensed medical professional in your state of residence. Today's episode was chock full of so many different topics. It was still really cohesive. So Bria Didato is an APRN who specializes in diabetes distress, diabetes management, ADHD, and metabolic dysfunction in general. So we talk about all of those things and blame and shame and diet culture and the different types of diabetes. There's type 1.5, type 3C. I actually had no idea, even though we've had so many diabetes episodes done on this show. So really excited for you to hear. Bria is clearly super, super knowledgeable in everything she does. We talk about proper testing and proper treatments and giving yourself grace. As you know, that's exactly what this podcast is all about. So we go into all of that and a little bit about Bria. She is a dually board certified licensed family and psychiatric nurse practitioner. She's been in nursing for over 17 years, and she spent her first decade working in hospital settings. So she really has an understanding of like community care and what was missing from community care. Over time, she realized she wanted to be on the other side of healthcare, the preventative side, and pursued her family nurse practitioner degree. Upon graduation, she moved to primary care for an FQHC community clinic. It was during her time working in primary care that she decided to specialize in mental health to better serve clients with their health goals. She noticed how heavily linked mental and physical health are, and that treating both produces better outcomes. During her post-master's degree in psychiatry, Bria was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes herself, and her own pursuit of stability and health while living with a chronic illness became a personal and professional passion. Bria now provides psychiatry services through her telehealth practice in Oregon, where she currently specializes in mental health for people with diabetes distress and chronic illness burnout. She provides both medication management and psychotherapy services.
Feeling quite under the weather today, but we will go on as planned.
You sure? We can reschedule. I'm not in any rush.
That's okay. I am. It's been like 2 weeks, and I'm just tired of camping and around, and I just want to be normal again.
Yeah. Lingering. It's rough, I know. When I got out of COVID this year, I was sick for like just weeks and weeks. So the fatigue was terrible, you know. It just
did
took
you
forever.
Come out of it.
Yeah, but it took probably like 4 weeks of just kind of like around between like noon and five, you would just, you know, hit a wall and had nothing left in you. It was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Did you get anything specific to kind of come out of it, like anything to support yourself through that, or did you just wait it out?
I'm kind of a big advocate already of just listening to your body. And so on those days, even though it was frustrating, I couldn't really go mountain biking or hiking or anything. My energy level was just super low. I did what I could. Like one day I got out and just did my pooper scooping in the yard for the animals. And by the end of it, I had to like take a nap, you know, just walking around my yard, picking up poop. And I was just like, that's okay. That's just where I am. And I'd rather deal with this than worry about like chronic fatigue setting in. It should get better. And it did over time. You know, I think the more we push ourselves, the longer it takes to heal from things in most cases. So.
I agree. That's a big one for me too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to get clients on board with that one.
Yeah. But I think just helping ourselves and other people recognize, like, you know, it's okay to have bad days and days where you need naps, and long term, it does better for you.
Yeah.
It was definitely not lost on me that we are sitting here talking about resting and listening to your body. Well, I started off the conversation saying that I was feeling under the weather and I didn't want to cancel, and I still wanted to do the interview. So I wanted to share this with you because, one, I think it's a good way to illuminate that I'm human. And sometimes we do push through things even when maybe we shouldn't. But I also wanted to talk about the fact that I pushed through because podcasting, I think I did mention it, you know, I said I'm kind of tired of canceling and rescheduling. I just want to feel human again. So it wasn't that I was pushing through sickness from a place of obligation or shame or shoulds. It was more like I really genuinely enjoy being social. And this was kind of the first time in 2 weeks I was having really anything social. So this podcast episode was recorded about a year ago. So sorry to Bria. She came on so wonderfully. And it took me forever. The last few episodes have actually been recorded quite a while ago. But in an effort to not burn out and to prioritize the things that needed to be prioritized last summer, I wasn't able to do editing and publishing and all of that. But here I am back at it, and we'll see how long this lasts. I'm not making any promises, but I can only hope that every time that I take a step away and then I come back into editing and publishing, that I get better and faster and it gets easier. So here's the rest of the interview. Yeah, let us know who you are, where you practice, who you see, and what you're most passionate about working with at the moment. I know that can change.
Sure. So my name is Bria Dodato. I am a nurse practitioner. I'm actually a double board certified and licensed. So I have my family nurse practitioner and my psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner license. As a nurse, I've been in healthcare since 2006. That's when I started my nursing career. I worked for a long time in acute care, critical care, oncology, cardiology, all that stuff in the hospital. For over like 10 years. And then I went and got my nurse practitioner degree and started in primary care. When I was in primary care, I realized pretty quickly that the healthcare goals that insurance companies create were really difficult to help people achieve because there was so much stuff going on with their mental health. And we just didn't have a lot of resources to help people. We didn't have counselors, you know, even people to manage their medications. It was like a 3 to 6 month waiting list in most areas. And so I just felt really underprepared to be a good resource to the community, having just my family nurse practitioner experience. So then I decided to go and get my postmaster's in psychiatry so that I could be better equipped to help people with their physical and mental health goals. During my go ahead.
Can I ask what is the difference between nurse practitioner and MD? Because it sounds
I think that's it. Yeah. Nurse practitioner. So NP, MD, DOPA. What does it all mean? So we are all clinically trained to prescribe medication, order tests, interpret those tests, create treatment plans with people. The difference really comes down to the core principles in our training. So in nursing, we are trained to approach health from that holistic perspective of we are supporting a person. We aren't just supporting the disease or disease management. And that's probably one of the biggest differences between MD and PA, because they go to traditional medical school. PAs can actually complete hours and bridge to become an MD, whereas nurse practitioners, there is no bridge for us. They don't count any of our education as equivalent to medical training. So that's kind of like the big difference. For DOs, they're also physicians. They have also a very holistic training background as well. They're trained in like chiropractic manipulation, supplements, you know, treating a whole person as well. But also they are considered to be physicians. So that's the biggest difference. Technically, we don't practice medicine. We practice advanced nursing because we didn't actually go to medical school. We went to nursing school and advanced practice programs. So I think the difference really shines in how we approach management of something in particular. So, for example, if you look at just diabetes, many physicians are trained to assess the glucose numbers, determine what medications, insulin, oral medications they may need, and then, you know, just kind of stick to that management path. But in nursing, we look at the whole person. So do they have access to food? What kind of access to food do they have? Do they have refrigeration for their insulin? What is their stress going on in their life? What is their financial access to pay for medications? And I think there's room at the table for everybody. You know, sometimes you'll see professionals arguing like it should only be MDs. NPs deserve autonomy. They don't deserve autonomy. Everybody's kind of got their own thing. I think really well-rounded care includes advanced practice nurses, PAs, MDs, DOs. I think there's room for us all at the table because we all carry really specific, approaches to managing health overall. Like, I know if I had a really super rare cancer, I'm going to want to talk to that physician who's kind of been specializing in that specific type of cancer for the last 20 years. And he may have terrible bedside manner, but I'm going to want to talk to him about my genetics and my risks, right?
Right, right. Yeah, it's it is sometimes hard to know, like, who to see. And you do hear, at least I hear, like, you know, those conversations. Someone should stick in their lane with this or that. And it's like, is it really that strict and that rigid? Or is there, one, there's room for us all at the table? And two, I think defining your scope of practice sometimes is very black and white, and other times it's just not. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah. I do a lot of education for people. So in my practice, now I do private practice, telepsychiatry for, you know, mostly mental health conditions. But I do also really like to work with people who have chronic conditions or are medically complex. And what I do for when I'm working with those people is first education about how to advocate for themselves within the system, when to seek out a specific specialist maybe, or go down the passage. Maybe we need to do some genetic testing, or maybe we do some nutritional testing as it relates to what's going on with the person. But I also do a lot of education around our limitations in Western medicine, because I think what I see a lot is people get burned out. You know, they have all of these physical or mental health symptoms. They go to their primary care, they get blood work done, they get testing done, and the primary care will say, oh, well, nothing's wrong with you. It's just your mental health. You're just anxious, or you're just depressed. You know, you need to exercise more and eat better and stop drinking alcohol. When the reality is, we are limited in our ability to diagnose a lot of things. Autoimmune diseases, for example, on average take about 5 years to actually diagnose. The reason it takes so long is we don't understand yet a lot about autoimmune conditions. Most of our markers for things, you're looking at disease that has progressed to a point to like alter a bloodline or cause inflammatory markers to elevate, right? But there's like all of this pre-disease that goes on for years that we just don't have the technology to pick up. And I think when we overemphasize the importance of the data point, well, your complete blood count was normal, or your inflammatory markers are normal, but the person is still having physical symptoms, it's best if we still work with that person and say, you may have a disease that develops in 5 years. I can't predict that, but I understand that you're in pain, or I understand that you're anxious. Here's some things that we could do to help alleviate that suffering in the meantime. And then we're just going to keep a watchful eye with you and on you to see if something develops down the road. I feel like that's a much better approach to first validating the person suffering, right? Instead of just gaslighting people, recognizing the limitations in our medical model and in our technology. We have a lot of them. COVID was a great example. And just working with people. Most of the time when you say that, people then realize, okay, well, so now my goal isn't that all of my suffering is going to be gone, but that someone's going to help me so that every day isn't so overwhelming that I can't care for myself or engage in life.
It's true. And it's really sad, because I think, you can't do anything until these labs show this thing. And it's like,
right.
And then on the flip, on the flip side is doctors will say, like, you know, just lose weight and eat better and exercise. And the thing is, like, those eating a balanced diet, whatever that looks like for you, it's individual for each person, and getting movement in your day is really beneficial. But when it's thrown at you in that context, it's like, it's just like, nothing's wrong with all, just do this. And it's like, I like how I don't know what 5 years will bring. Disease happens over time. It's not just this thing that, like, you wake up with one day. And we also don't know what it is your body might need to help potentially prevent that thing from happening. But we can go on a journey together with it, and we can we do what we were talking before we started recording about meeting yourself where you're at. And so, if a patient's like, well, okay, do I focus on a diet, or do I focus on
exercise directions. We focus on whatever it is you feel capable and confident in focusing on.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. I think the some of the trouble with our Western medicine recommendations and health management is there's a lot of blame and shame, you know, with kind of within that model of, well, you're just stressed.
Be less stressed.
What does that even mean? Right. Like, I'm, you know, spouse and I have young children and, you know, daycare is expensive and I don't get paid enough and I'm commuting too much. I mean, there's so yeah, I'll meditate while I'm in the car or step in bumper to bumper.
Right.
Like, what does that even mean? Right.
And I, exactly. You know, I
do think that recognizing all of the factors that are contributing to someone's emotional or physical suffering helps them want to understand where some of those really significant pain points are. And then if at all there's anything that they can alter in that moment, sometimes there isn't a lot somebody can do just because of where they are financially or emotionally or what their other obligations are in their life. And just saying, you know, I'm really sorry you're going through this right now. What can I do to support you and meet you where you are? Right. I understand that these things are hard. How do I help you get through this and want to get up tomorrow and do the same thing over again? Right. That goes a long way for a lot of people. Instead of just trying to cure things, it's just recognizing like things are really tough right now. And I'm really sorry. What can I do?
No. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, especially with like insurance mandates and the way we have to write treatment plans and we have to, I understand the dilemma of the practitioner, you know, to be able to, okay, well, we have to put something down. But if you are asking the right questions, the patient can choose what that's going to be. And that's going to be far more powerful. Of course, if you've got some labs that show X, Y, and Z, you know, you can lead them in that direction. But if it is a conversation of like, there isn't really anything we can do. Where are you at in your life? What kind of lifestyle change are you wanting right now? What are you wanting to work on? Is there something rather than me trying to tell you to lose weight and eat low carb when, you know, and maybe that's not available to you at the moment, but maybe a daily walk with your children is like maybe getting outside and getting some sun is like something that really lights you up and you want to do. So it's, it's supposed to be collaborative.
Yeah. But helping people recognize that it is those tiny little moments that actually they're engaging and care for themselves and to give themselves credit for. A lot of times people will say, I'm failing. I feel like I'm failing at life because I'm not exercising 5 days a week. I only exercise 2 and I didn't make it. I'm not meeting my goals. And helping them recognize that you exercise 2 days that week.
It sounds like it was a tough week for you. I want you to pat yourself on the back. Like that is care, right? And there's a difference between short-term goals that are achievable right now because you have the financial capacity, the time capacity, you know, all of those other resources are in place. And then there's like long-term goals. And I find a lot of people will look at those long goals, like I want to be someone who exercises 5 days a week. And because I'm not there, that means I'm failing every single week at doing this and not recognizing that actually you are on a journey to meet that goal. That's a long goal. So maybe a year down the road or 2 years down the road, you're there. But right now, you're just contemplating it or putting the shoes on, you know, or getting it. And it doesn't have to be the hour at the gym. Like make those goals, things that are achievable where you're at. And then maybe, you know, you can look at that as a long goal, but you're not failing in the meantime.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's really important for people to maybe just rewind the last 30 seconds of this interview and listen to that again. Cause it's important. It's not your feeling. You're right. If like all you do is build the habit of putting your shoes on to go outside for the walk, but you don't get outside to the walk. And that's how I built most of my habits. And it took a good 10 plus years to get to a place where I feel really confident in like my health routine. I'm curious, what are your kind of main go-tos for people that you do help, like you want to see them doing lifestyle changes or, and of course, everyone is so different. So you can speak to the nuance there, but what are some of your go-tos?
So I think, it's very individual. The first thing I think is important to assess with a client is
I worry a lot about body dysmorphia. And so I'm very careful about when I talk, when it comes to like movement and nutrition plans, because many people, all genders, all ages, with social media are just really caught up in that comparison and this, a lot of those myths around a specific weight or body type that equals health. So first I assess where somebody is and ensure that my recommendations aren't going to add to any more distress they may have about their body. I do believe that there are nutrition approaches that can certainly help people, but not everybody needs the same approach. So, and I think you and I spoke about this before, but specifically for people with diabetes, there's this idea that, you know, everybody needs to be low carb. And there's a lot of pressure out in the world of diabetes from professionals and even other people who have the condition to say, like, you need to exercise every day and you need to eat less than 100 carbs a day, grams, 50 grams a day, you know, depending on that spectrum, right? I think that nutrition can be a very powerful tool in management of blood sugar for someone who happens to have diabetes or may have insulin resistance and genetically be predisposed to obesity. But it's not a cure. And we always have to look at, is this tool useful in this moment right now? Or is this going to cause any additional distress? Because it's complicated, right? Like weight is complicated and blood sugar management is complicated. There are so many factors that cause blood sugar to be above range or below range outside of how many donuts you ate. I mean, sometimes we do more damage to each other when we don't understand the full complexity of glucose management or weight management and the genetics that are going on behind and the pathophysiology of it. And when we oversimplify things and hold people to a standard that's not realistic or achievable based on their resources, we just need to be really careful about how we talk about those things. And so my recommendation always is like just to meet the person where they are, understand what is within their realm of control right now, in that none of that stuff is a cure. It's a tool, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way that you explained that individualized approach, because I think sometimes the conversation just ends there. Like, oh, it's individual, depends on the person. But just hearing again, like, and maybe we can talk a little bit more too about what are those other pieces that contribute to blood sugar dysregulation.
So right now we know that there's over 40 factors that influence glucose. There's a good article about it on the Diatribe website that just includes, you know, where our hormones are. So from many people who are born female during their menstrual cycle, they'll see more insulin resistance the week before the week of period. So that can contribute. Exercise and the type of exercise that you're doing can either cause your blood sugar to go low or to go high. So, you know, even though it's great for us, sometimes we have to be careful in which exercise we're engaging in. Caffeine, coffee, I have zero carbs in my coffee. It will make my blood sugar rise. I have to give a unit of insulin for it. Many people, even professionals, don't understand that. Temperature changes, altitude changes, our own stress level, all of those things are going to impact what's going on with our metabolic regulation. For people who have diabetes, and one of the things that a lot of people don't understand too is all of the types of diabetes. We have so many different types, type 1, type 2, type 1.5, type 3C, steroid-induced diabetes, chronic pancreatitis-induced diabetes. You know, there's so many factors. And when you consider what is the root cause and the pathophysiology of that diabetes? And is the person appropriately diagnosed and has access to the appropriate medications to manage that diabetes? That's a huge thing. Not a lot of people are correctly diagnosed. And that really can set people up for burnout because they don't have the proper education or medications to manage the type of diabetes that they have. What works and helps the type 1 may not help another type. And so it's really important that they are educated in how to care for themselves.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know about the other. I only knew about type 1 and type 2. So, and I've actually done maybe 4 or 5 episodes already on diabetes. So that's, I love getting new information like that. I'm assuming it is not easy to figure out which type someone has. Those other subtypes.
So part of the issue is And I can say this from primary cares that I've worked with and in my own training to do primary care. The guidelines don't recommend that we assess how much insulin somebody is producing, which is pretty frustrating. There's kind of an assumption that if somebody develops diabetic numbers and they're past the age of 20, past the age of 30, that it's likely to be type 2. And that's because statistically, it's the most common type of diabetes. I think a lot of these other types would actually get caught a lot sooner if primary care was trained to evaluate if the person who's diabetic is actually producing insulin appropriately. And there are several tests that can certainly do that, but it's not the first go-to. And I do believe that it should be. If I see somebody who has had a diagnosis of diabetes and they're struggling, sometimes I will circle back and even order genetic testing or C-peptide testing. That's how we assess insulin, stress testing, glucose stress testing for somebody to see if their pancreas is responding correctly. That's going to tell you a lot. The other thing that tells us a lot about what their genetic risk is for something like MODY, MODY is a monogenic diabetes. It means that there is one particular mutation within the metabolic realm that's causing the diabetes. So sometimes they won't secrete enough insulin. It's not autoimmune. It's totally separate. There's actually 14 different genetic mutations that can cause it. So if you have multiple parents or first degree relatives with diabetes, and this person maybe has like a average BMI, there's somebody who exercises, their diet is pretty average. They're on medications, they're not responding, glucose still remains high despite all of those interventions. That's somebody you want to circle back and say, is the diagnosis actually correct here? And I just don't think in our medical world, we're taught enough to say, in mental health, right? If we have a diagnosis and they're not responding, it's not getting better. The symptoms are still all there. And the person is like, I'm trying so hard. I don't know why this isn't getting better. You always step back and say, do I have the right diagnosis? And I think we need to do a better job of that when it comes to people with diabetes.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What is the reason why people don't go to those tests first or at all?
They're not trained to. It's not, I find the, so when I was going through my postmaster's in psychiatry, that's when I got my type 1. I was 38 years old. Over 50% of type 1 new onset is actually in adults. There's a big, kind of misunderstanding about that in the background too. A lot of people assume it's just kids. Thankfully, in my own primary care rotation, I worked with another nurse practitioner who had a really intensive diabetes rotation through UCSF. And so she taught me about type 1.5, which is type 1 onset in adults, one of the types. So once I knew that, and then I got diagnosed with diabetes, I knew pretty quickly I was a type one, like right away. I had lost 35 pounds, hair was falling out. My fasting blood sugar was in the 400s, which is incredibly high. My A1C was 14. I had no history of diabetes before that, none in pregnancy, no elevated A1Cs prior. I was like really confused. I had all the signs of GKA like 2 days before I got diagnosed. And so I knew this is pretty traditional type 1 onset. And when I went to go talk to my primary carer about what was going on, she even said, this is probably just a really bad type 2. And I said, oh, no, this is a type 1. I have all the signs of type 1. So even in the medical community, like we just don't have that education. And so after I got diagnosed, and got stable, which took a little bit, I started to really dive into the education that's out there because I was frustrated. Like, and I loved my primary care. She was an amazing human being, really caring. But I was like, why is this primary care who's so educated and was a physician almost misdiagnosed me? I had to push for getting antibodies checked. And it's because we're just not trained to do it. And so thankfully the diabetic community can be an incredible resource for people who have these diseases. You have to take it with a grain of salt too. Sometimes it can be a little too much information or inaccurate, but there is a lot of information out there. And once you start to read the research, read the other statistics, learn about the genetics behind it, there's a lot of missing information in our medical education.
Yeah. Wow. it's good to have this. This is part of why I have these conversations, because how would someone know? You know, now they can take this conversation and just research more, like do some more. Google more about what you just, they can take the keywords of what you just said and just look into it.
Yeah. Well, I think too, there is some really good vetted information out there. So for people who want to know, do I actually have a, like, am I type one and not type two? There's a company called TrialNet that will do antibody testing for free for people. There's 6 antibodies. That's another thing I find is a lot of primary cares endocrinologists won't test for all 6. They'll only test for 1 antibody, the most common. And if the person doesn't have that particular antibody, then they'll say, oh, you're not a type one, you're a type two. Antibodies don't stay in a consistent elevated state either. It depends on the disease process for somebody. So if they actually had a diabetes that was autoimmune, over time, once they've gotten to a point where all of the beta cells, so type one diabetes is where the autoimmune system attacks the beta cells in the pancreas, which creates the insulin in the body. And then once all of those beta cells have been attacked and died off, the person is no longer able to produce insulin. Once that process is over, you're not going to see a lot of antibodies anymore. So to say to somebody, well, you're not producing insulin, but you don't have antibodies, it doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't a type 1. That process may have just completed. Or checking to see if they have MODY, because that has reduced insulin production as well and won't have any antibodies. So just kind of looking at that whole clinical picture.
Yeah, these are really important kind of, I don't know if myths are the right words, but misconceptions and to bring to light. Are there other things that people commonly miss like that?
Yeah, I mean, you really have to look at genetic risk by talking to people about their family history. So for me, like I had said, I had no diabetes previously in my life. But after I got my diagnosis, I went back to my family and started talking to them and realized I had autoimmune conditions in both sides of my family pretty heavily. So somebody who has a genetic risk of developing some type of an autoimmune condition, and or they also already have an autoimmune disease, if they develop diabetes, should be assessed for type 1. Because like Hashimoto's and type 1 are very common together. Celiac and type 1 are common together. As we say, many people who get autoimmune conditions will develop maybe 3 over time. It kind of, we joke that it comes in 3s. So it's good to ensure that there isn't a risk of this being an autoimmune condition. Like in my family, I had Sjogren's and Hashimoto's and Graves and celiac, like in all family and cousins. And I was like, oh, okay. Having no idea that I even carried that risk, but it's good for clinical providers to be asking those questions, right?
Yeah, that's probably also hard just because a lot of people don't know their family history.
Yeah.
And can't even answer. I know, like, on my own paperwork, and I know, like, there are some diseases that have floated around in my family, but I'm pretty sure in a lot of places, I just don't even check things off because I'm like, the patient also can give you very inaccurate information. I've been that patient for sure. Because sometimes I don't want to talk about like the mental illness in my family. I already know about X, Y, and Z. I don't want you reporting that to my insurance and I don't know. Those are probably all like fears from, I don't know if they're founded or not, but. Yeah. Can you maybe talk a little bit about patient history, accurate history giving?
I learned a long time ago. We have intake forms, but I do go over every single question that was already asked and asked again. I can't tell you how many times, just yesterday I was talking to somebody. Do you see any other specialists? No, not at all. Just a primary care, nobody else. And then starting to go through, like, do you have skin issues? Do you have weight changes? How is your hair? How is your nails? How is your GI tract? How is your sexual health? Like all of it. And then all of a sudden, I actually do see a dermatologist once a year because I have a high history of skin cancer in my family. And I've got some things that are kind of pre-skin cancerous. So I guess I do see another specialist, right? Happens all the time. And it's not that people intentionally leave things out. I myself forget to put stuff down. We're all pretty complicated individuals. We get a lot of stuff to to figure out. So I try really hard to touch on all of those points when I'm getting to know somebody. It's complicated.
Yeah. It's hard too when you know, like, I know my mom has had several different diagnoses, but like, she's also been labeled a hypochondriac her whole life. And so, like, you know, in my head growing up, like, none of the things she was experiencing was real, like, because that was the narrative that I heard about her.
Yeah.
And so even though I know that's no longer true now, like, that follows. So when I am filling out this paperwork, I'm like, well, I don't know. Does she have that? Does she have this? Or then even like my dad, like, he has diabetes. He was diagnosed within the last 10 or 15 years, totally controlled by diet. So he doesn't get insulin. He lives in a hospital, so he, like, very kind of strictly regimented food, and then he doesn't. So in my head, there's this confusion even there of, like, wait, does he have it? Does he, like, I forget, like, if he has it or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, there's all these things that happen, which is why the conversation that you're mentioning is so important, because when you're talking about these things, one, you have the knowledge to be able to maybe clarify some confusion that a patient might have.
Yeah. Yep.
And then two, like, just talking it out loud is way different than like checking things off on a paper.
Yeah. Yeah. And also understanding too, especially when we look back at our history for mental health and Western medicine, we do a lot of misdiagnosis. So I often will take many things with kind of a grain of salt. Like when someone will say, in my family, you know, my mom was bipolar. I had a grandmother that was, you know, manic depressive, or, and yes, there are some genetic risks or family risks when we see some specific conditions, but it doesn't mean that the person originally diagnosed had the correct diagnosis. And so you still, sure, I can keep it in the back of my mind as maybe a differential, maybe this person does have a mood disorder, bipolar too. You know, maybe there is a history of psychosis, just keeping an eye out for it, but it doesn't mean that that's going to lead to that person having the same diagnosis, because they still, this is a different person, different experience. And we don't know if the original diagnosis was correct in the family member.
Yeah. I was just talking about this with someone the other day. She was like, my grandmother was actually put into a mental asylum. And it's like, and so this particular person has a their own medical condition. Like, you know, your grandmother probably had that medical condition that's highly genetic, and didn't know one had answers for her, and told her it was all, like, her pain wasn't real, and that led to hysteria, and that led to really bad.
Yeah. Especially for anyone who's born female, right? I mean, look at her. We still just do not understand enough about hormones and female health. And I mean, look at endometriosis, right? We're still just finally getting into the complexity of it. When you talk about a disease that passes the uterine wall, and I've had clients who've had endometriosis in their lungs, and the years that they suffered and went to doctors and said, I have chest pain, I can't breathe. What, especially around my menstrual cycle, my pain increases. I can feel it up into my ribs. Oh, that's just period pain, right? No, it's not. Even like the surgical interventions, you know, we do have some people who are doing great work and specialize in it, but still, to have a condition that requires you to have invasive surgery and parts of your body removed, we need to do a better job recognizing those signs in people. And certainly, for decades, women were told that their pain isn't real, that their suffering isn't real, that they're just anxious, they're histrionic. And in the meantime, they're suffering from like a chronic inflammatory condition, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Where everything hurts and
everything hurts. No one believes you. All of your receptors are being activated. Your, you know, serotonin, norepinephrine. I mean, it's real.
One of my biggest pains is when people are like, oh, like, why all of a sudden do people have so much of this diagnosis? Everyone has anxiety now, or everyone has whatever now. With physical conditions, they say it too.
Yeah.
And it really bothers me, because I'm like, we didn't have the right diagnosing in the past. Like, this isn't just random. Like, people were thrown into mental institutes because they had real pain and no one believed them. Like, this not new. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new about this. I mean, I'm sure there's probably a cool conversation to be had about increased incidence as well of different diseases based on environmental factors and whatnot. But sure. I also think there's just so much more that we weren't aware of before.
I think with, you know, one of the benefits of the internet and social media is there are more people that are talking about and normalizing asking for help. And when I have clients who come to me and say like, oh, I saw this TikTok video and I'm pretty sure that I have ADHD or I have this or that. It doesn't bother me and it doesn't offend me. I try to approach it from this person has some target symptoms that are bothering them and holding them back in some way. And so helping them figure that out, whether it's ADHD or not, you know, we'll figure that out with an assessment. But I don't know. It doesn't insult me. I don't think of it as like someone telling me how to practice my craft. I partner with people to help figure out what's going on. You know, the real question is why somebody was looking at that to begin with and what it is they think, you know, could change in their lives if they had some type of a diagnosis and help. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It actually opens the conversation to them illuminating their symptoms to be able to specify the symptoms more. Well, you know, this TikTok said this thing and I have just that. And it's like, yes. Okay. Now we have verbiage for it before. Whereas before it was like, I don't know. I just feel off, you know, like a very, they didn't have the language for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or being told, well, you know, just stop watching TV so much. That's why you have focus problems, or it's from your video games, or, you know, you just need to eat better and sleep better when there is actually real clinically significant and impairing executive dysfunction going on, right? From whatever cause. Yeah.
And I won't go too much on a soapbox around that, but even just like the sleep issues, like, is it really just a matter of, like, one, yes, we can have this executive dysfunction that's making it hard, but how does your environment play into that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're trying to get somebody with executive dysfunction to have this high, this nightly hygiene, this routine, you know, no screens before bed, brush your teeth, then this, then that, then like that might, but why do we have to even live like that? Like, why do we have to have this? Regimented procedures and, you know, that we have, it's like people didn't live like that 200 years ago. People slept in the same beds 200 years ago. Like their families all lived under one roof. They like, there's so much more like from a social perspective as well, just that can impact one's ability to do the things that they need to do, like brush their teeth. That's not just about,
Yeah. When I do ADHD coaching with clients, we often talk about, you know, just in the realm of like executive dysfunction and sleep, what are their actual goals and how is their brain working at that portion of the day? Right. So many people with ADHD actually become really activated into the evening. And they'll say like, this is my time to shine. 9 p.m. is when I clean the house. Midnight is when I do all my computer programming and then I'm out for 3 hours and I get a week's worth of work done in those 3 hours and it's great and I'm excited. And that's fine. If that's something that is achievable, you know, in their professional or personal life, they can maintain those hours. I don't have an issue with it as long as they're still getting some type of sleep. But I think it's important for them and for us to understand that not everybody needs to be to bed by 9. Some people do actually cognitively do really well into the evening, whereas the people with ADHD, many of them have morning dysfunction and cognitive tempo impairment in the morning. And so forcing them to wake up at 6 a.m. and be ready for that board meeting at 7, that's going to be really rough for them. So there's going to be different techniques and tools and recommendations to help that person assimilate to the neurotypical hours and world. Versus the computer programmer who can easily stay up at midnight programming and doesn't have meetings starting until noon. But understanding that for people, like that sleep hygiene recommendation isn't going to be appropriate for the computer programmer who shines at midnight. Like, that's fine. Let him stay up because he's going to catch up to the sleep somewhere else. And the same for people who have other conditions like chronic pain, you know, they woken up constantly at night because they're uncomfortable. I know for myself, because I wear medical devices, I have beeping going on all the time. I may have a high blood sugar that I need to address, or a low and I need to get up and eat. Like, there are so many things that happen that we just can't always control. We can try our best, but it doesn't mean you're failing at life because we don't have sleep hygiene, right?
100%. Yes. I love that you addressed that, the individual differences. And it's hard if you have the body and mind of someone who shines at midnight and do have a job, you know, that you require, that you lean on, you need for your livelihood. And you know, it makes you get up at 7 a.m. or more. So yeah, that's where the individual differences come in. And that's where the work that you're doing also comes in.
Yeah.
The other piece that I wanted to ask is about metabolic dysfunction. We kind of briefly talked about that last time we met. And I'm just curious, can you kind of define metabolic dysfunction and where you see that play out, like with different diseases? Or is that more just, when we were talking about it, was it just towards diabetes? What does metabolic dysfunction mean, and how does it play out in your practice?
Yeah, there are other conditions beyond diabetes that cause irregularities in our metabolic system. So if you learn a little bit about the physiology of our metabolic system, it's a really tightly controlled system, right? It depends on like how quickly your stomach is processing food and those nutrients and glucose are hitting the system or the bloodstream. Your pancreas releasing insulin and amylin, which helps with like hunger and feeling full, and also contributes to your stomach emptying. Your liver, when it starts to release glucose as well, because your blood sugar is getting low or high. So all of these things depend on each other. And even within that system, like how your cells are going to respond to insulin, what you are naturally producing, how effective it's going to be, how many receptors you have, like all of that stuff. When there's one portion genetically that's been altered, so maybe you're not producing as much insulin or as much amylin, or your liver is overproducing glucose, it affects the rest of the system because it all requires these signals to turn on or turn off. And so when one tiny little signal is affected, it's either overproducing or underproducing or just kind of sporadically doing its thing, it's going to cause all of these other issues like changes to weight, changes to hunger, and of course blood sugar changes as well, as an example. There are other conditions like thyroid conditions that can cause that, right? Somebody who's got an underactive thyroid because maybe they have Hashimoto's, it's going to change their metabolism. So that's why we see weight gain with them, and we see insulin resistance with them, and we address the thyroid and we regulate those hormones. We see cholesterol numbers that improve, and we see their glucose numbers improve as well. So it's not just diabetes. There are anything that's kind of within our metabolic or endocrine system can cause metabolic irregularities. And that's why I say, I think when we oversimplify how to manage it, we set people up for failure, right? I see so many people with thyroid issues or with diabetes that are like, I'm exercising, I'm taking my meds, I'm doing my insulin, I'm still having highs, I'm still having lows, I don't, you know what else to do, but not actually being taught there are some types of exercise that are actually going to bring your blood sugar down versus ones that are going to bring it up. There are other tools in your toolbox that you don't even know are there. Let's talk about those and give you more resources instead of, you know, like a type 2's, my heart goes out to them. They'll have like blood sugar in the 200 or 300s, and they don't even have access to insulin many times to just bring that number down. And so then they're just sitting in the 200 and 300s, not knowing that there are other tools like taking a hot shower can help bring their blood sugar down, or taking a 15-minute walk outside can bring it down. But to be careful, because it can go, you know, the other direction and cause a low or be uncomfortable. We just need to be better about all of the tools and educating people on how to use them, and that it's okay. Sometimes we're stuck in the 200 and 300s, and we're doing the best we can as long as we're safe. The number doesn't mean anything other than what is the next tool that I need to reach for to help me get back into my goal range. Not I'm saline and I'm a bad diabetic, because there's really no such thing as someone who's a bad diabetic.
I think the fear of that number too. Like, I mean, yeah, going too high and am I going to die? And
yeah,
some of like these intense fears. And what I'm hearing is that through the education, just the education alone can reduce that fear because, again, you have tools. So you're not just sitting there like, oh my God, what is my body doing to me? And what is it going to do next? It's like, I have some control over this, not total control. Like I'm not, you know, a magician, but
I have something. And then also knowing like, when do I need to have a more intense intervention? Like, do I need to go to the emergency room? Do I need to talk to my endocrinologist right now and get some medication? That's, you know, those are the things that, because one of the other things I help people with is diabetes distress, something a lot of people don't know exists. But, you know, about 50% of diabetics will experience distress at some point in their disease process. Sometimes it's at first diagnosis, development of another complication, you know, other stressors going on in their lives. Yeah.
When you say distress, you mean just like mental stress, or are you saying that is that like a specific?
It's a very specific condition for people who have diabetes that they can actually get to a point of distress where they are just totally burnt out. So, and you usually will see this in diabetics who are maybe like on the verge of getting hospitalized because they're no longer able to engage in that self-care. So maybe they've stopped giving themselves insulin because they're burnt out, or they're just eating, you know, without counting the carbs and dosing for the medication. Or dosing for the carbohydrates. They've stopped engaging in exercise. They're depressed. And it's not a depression. It's actually a diabetes management burnout or distress that's happening. There is actually a website that people can go to. It's diabetesdistress.org. There's a really great psychologist in Southern California who created that website and helps people with this too. So there's a scale, just like we use for other health professionals. We use PHQ-9 and GAD and all of those other screening tools. There's actually one specific for diabetes distress that you can administer to people who have diabetes type 1 or type 2 or other types. And it helps us identify what portion of life with diabetes is actually causing or contributing to the burnout. Some of it is financial distress because managing their diabetes is so expensive. Some of it is family or friend induced. They feel judged or shamed when they're eating. There's a lot of shame around how we eat when we're a diabetic. All of a sudden, everybody has an opinion about what I'm eating. Some of it is like healthcare provider induced, you know, going to those appointments and hearing about how my numbers aren't in range and how we talk about it and the language is being used. So there's all of these separate factors happening. Some of it's like fear of complication or fear of lows that's stressing people out. So it's important for us to recognize how complex it is to be in charge all of a sudden of managing your metabolic health, not always having all of the resources, not always having really good language around it or understanding around it from, you know, inside personally and outside, you know, externally, how people are talking about me and to me. And then helping people understand that they have some autonomy over what those things are, how those conversations are going, and that there are other tools available. The good thing about diabetes distress is when we recognize what's going on and we assess it and we address it, the recovery from it is actually quite high. Unlike some other like chronic depression or anxiety disorders, this is a bit separate. So when we empower diabetics with the appropriate knowledge and information, that distress will improve.
That's really important. Yeah, the burnout piece. It is. It's hard to keep up with it all. And I'm glad to know there's resources out there. I'll definitely add those into the show notes. Do you have any like resources on your website? Anything like, or is it you practice one-on-one? I know you have a group practice.
Yeah.
What are your offerings for people?
Yeah. I definitely specialize in ADHD, chronic illness, burnout, diabetes, distress. So that's kind of my preferred population. My colleagues have some of their own specialties. Like I have some who really like to do perinatal and postpartum mental health. Other people who also specialize in neurodiversity in the practice. Most of that is on the website. Like you can see each clinical provider, what they kind of specialize in. If for resources specific to diabetes, it is pretty individual. Like if I have someone who happens to be a diabetic and see me, and I will send them the scales, I will send them
specific resources for getting more information. I'm happy to actually send you some of those links as well so that you can post it on there, because I do think that it helps people to just have access to that information whenever. The other info that I really like is taking control of your diabetes. It's actually two endocrinologists who have a website, and they do a lot of videos. They both happen to have type 1 diabetes, and I really love their approach in, you know, just living day-to-day life with diabetes. Like, they have a video where they eat 3 donuts in a row, and they show people how they use different insulins to manage their blood sugar for those donuts. They have a video where they drink alcohol, and they show people how to stay safe and have a low overnight. And, you know, it's just real life. And I think that's the benefit of talking to providers who actually have diabetes and know how stressful it is to live day to day with this, that you can actually have the donuts, whether you're a type 1 or type 2, and here's how to do it safely. Should we, any of us, have donuts every day? No, but can we? You know, it's a personal decision to make, right?
Yeah. I love that. That's wonderful. Thank you for all of that. Is there anything else that you feel is important to leave people with today?
I would say mental and physical health is a journey. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It's a journey. Be patient with yourself. Be empathetic with yourself. And make sure you have a good team who is working with you and understanding you. And that goes a long way. And if it's not a good team member, it's okay to move on.
Yeah. That's big too. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure having this conversation with you today. Yeah.
Anytime. I hope you have a good day.
Thanks for listening. If you learned something new today, consider writing it down in your phone notes or journal and make that new neural pathway light up. Better yet, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a DM on Instagram, email me, or leave a voice memo for us to play on the next show. The way you summarize your takeaways can be the perfect little soundbite that someone else might need. And lastly, leaving a review really helps others find this podcast, so please do if you found this episode helpful. And P.S., clicking subscribe ensures you'll be here for the next episode. See you then.